Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about the epic music, colorful characters, and problematic elements of Led Zeppelin. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review some new music from Sir and Waxahachie.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car-selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I know right here I would not be if she knew that I was only yours. Less than perfect. See, this is right where I want.
That is a little bit of the track Only Human from the new album by Sir Heavy. Sir Darryl Francis, known in the music world as Sir, stylized capital S, small I, capital R, is a singer and songwriter born in Inglewood, California, who released his debut album, Greg, quite a while back, 2015, in the indies. It was the third album, 2019, that really kind of brought him to the majors and much wider attention. Fascinating early life. His mom had been a backup singer for, among others, Michael Jackson, Anita Baker, and the great Chaka Khan. He had a cousin who wrote songs for the Pussycat Dolls. Musical family, grew up surrounded by music, went on to study recording engineering to record his own albums, very much in Prince-like fashion, often doing much of the music himself. It's been 5 years since we got a new album from Sir. Now Heavy is dropping. In that space, he kind of bottomed out. I mean, there was the pandemic and depression. There was extramarital affairs that he now questions the wisdom of. His marriage has survived. And there was substance abuse. And so this is an album about his path back from hitting bottom. We'll play a track from it. We'll come back and give our opinions. We're going to play Ricky's song. Ricky is Sir's nephew. And it's one of those, you know, black moms always talk about having the talk with their black sons about what they're going to face in the world. And this is Sir trying to pass his hard-won wisdom to a loved one in his family. Ricky's song by Sir from the album Heavy on Sound Opinions.
In my warning, it's been written.
That is Ricky's song from the new Sir album, Heavy. I love that song. It's Sir looking out, thinking and writing and singing to someone other than himself. This record is very inward looking. This is an example of a song, one example of him looking outward and reaching out a hand to a younger person and saying, basically, I've gone through this. You don't want to go through the same experiences I've had.
Don't make the mistakes
here's
I
a way
made.
To, yeah. Here's a way to navigate that. And it's a beautiful song. Sir's got an incredibly versatile voice. He's been sort of a neo, lumped into the new neo-soul brigade the last few records. The previous records were more atmospheric and more in that neo-soul vein. One of the things I dislike about this record is it's trying to be a little bit more contemporary with the immediacy of the beats, the trap, you know, hip-hop programming, a little bit cliché, shall we say, on some of the arrangements. For a guy who's super talented, I think, is a great songwriter, potentially. Ditto for some of the lyrics. Some lyrics that weren't really thought through. You know, we're going to make a song tonight. It's about you, you know.
Yeah.
A bedroom
yeah.
jam. And then you've got Karma, where he's talking about, lately I've been burning the candle at both ends. Boy, how long did it take you to come up with lines like that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit cliché. There are a handful of really great songs. And people are wondering, why are you reviewing this guy? I think he's super talented. I'm still waiting for the end-to-end masterpiece, but you could put together a collection of Sir's songs, and I think you'd really have something. And I would mention Six Whole Days in particular, that sparse opening, that bouncy keyboard riff.
Staring at the sun for six whole days, blinded by my own foolish ways. If she don't, we all gonna fade to black.
It becomes a pop song.
Yeah.
It's about personal reckoning.
A pop song about being up on a bender and not being able to sleep for six whole days.
Right. He's dealing with a lot of heaviness here, and I appreciate that willingness to be vulnerable and to talk about these issues. No Evil, man. That's like a throwback to Sly Stone, There's a Riot Going On days, you know, that rawness in that vocal.
Show me what you made of. I've been lonely for days and days, but we're one in the same. Part of my superstition.
And he's talking to the devil, and I think the devil's him in this song.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's heavy stuff. I think it's fantastic. I love the collaboration with Anderson .Paak. At first, I didn't read any of the credits, and I go, that sounds like an Anderson .Paak song. And lo and
sure
behold,
enough,
he's collaborating with them on
that
track.
Had first worked together in 2014, and now they're Anderson's returning the favor.
If I slip, I slide, I don't trip. I glide when I dip. I dive when I dive deep. In the middle of her ocean, you know where to find me. When it's poetry in motion, she don't ever mind me. If I slip, I slide, I don't trip. I glide when I dip, I dive when I dive deep, in the middle of an ocean, you know.
And Ricky's song's a classic, but, you know, again, there's a handful of really, really great songs on here, and I think some low points. It's not a completely compelling work.
Well, you know, I knew the name Sir, and I'd admired stuff he'd done in the past. You know, it's always a challenge, Craig, when we're reviewing records, how much of the backstory is necessary to appreciate the album.
Mm-hmm.
If you came at this strictly as, well, I'm going to check this out, I don't know much about the artist, or here's the latest from an artist I've admired, some of the language is harsh, equating being addicted to women the same way he was to a needle. The language he's using, you know, could be off-putting. And then you hear Sir talk about it. There was a great interview he did with A. Martinez on NPR. He was talking in the voice of where he was when he was at rock bottom. And then you come to understand. But absent that context and even appreciate, which is more necessary for some songs than others, you don't need to know what he personally went through to appreciate Ricky's song. Some of the others you do. I agree. This is half of a great album from an artist who's yet to make his, you know, let's stay in the neo-soul range realm, yet to make his voodoo like D'Angelo.
Right.
But I think he's capable.
Absolutely.
Laying out eggshells. Been yours for so long. Come right back to
That is a track called Right Back to It from the new Waxahachie record, Tiger's Blood. Sixth album from Waxahachie. The nom de rock of the ongoing music project by one Katie Crutchfield. She's been putting out records since 2010 after her stint in the band with her sister and P.S. Eliot. It's named after Waxahachie Creek in Alabama, where she grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, a return to her roots. And I think you really heard that return to the roots on her fifth album, which was a real breakthrough, St. Cloud. She had been making a series of increasingly expansive records since that really what really started out as a bedroom project became more and more fleshed out over the years.
Yeah, her voice and acoustic guitar. That was where it began.
That's right. So St. Cloud in 2020 was a real breakthrough. Got back to some of that roots music that was in her blood from an early age and combining it with the indie rock that she'd been doing it previously. Now we've got the much-anticipated follow-up to that record, Tiger's Blood. Let's play a song from it before we review it. It's called Burns Out at Midnight from Waxahachie.
If I put up a fight, it'll follow me home. I think I might stay out dancing. If my blood runs cold with a heart of stone and my fire burns out at midnight. I get home from working hard, honey. State the obvious and watch your work its way in. We've been checked out, chasing the money. And I've been trying to tell them it ain't no way to live.
Burns Out at Midnight from the new Waxahachie album, Tiger's Blood. You know, Greg, I'll confess, I respected Katie Crutchfield's music more than I loved it for the first couple of albums. And then St. Cloud was the turning point for me in 2020. And Tiger's Blood continues that high. I am now a fan. It took me a while to really appreciate her voice. And I think the more expansive musical settings that we're getting, you know, really add to things. We've got some impressive guests on this record. MJ Lenderman came by to play on a song, stuck around for the whole album, mm-hmm. and a drummer, you know, Jeff Tweedy's son.
Yeah, Spencer Tweedy.
Spencer Tweedy.
A very good drummer.
Playing excellent drums here. The musical settings are ambitious, and so is the storytelling. I mean, novelistic eye, when we're talking about singer-songwriters, is a cliche. But Katie has one. And in between, you know, this album and St. Cloud, Sobriety, you know, she struggled to get her life together. She's described this album as being, you know, songs about late night fights with loved ones, friendships frayed beyond repair, and elegies for an idyllic past that may never have existed. I can't come up with better words than her own. She set out to tell those ambitious tales. She tells them well. The music is absolutely winning, and now I even love Katie's voice. I think this is a great album.
Yeah, it's a very good record. It grew on me because I was so impressed by the previous record. I wondered where she could go from there. She was once again working with Brad Cook, who did a terrific mm-hmm. job on that record. You know, a guy who's worked with Bon Iver and His Golden Messenger. Did expand the sound in a really interesting way with the addition, you know, helping incorporate those acoustic instruments. And you see that again. The acoustic guitars are, you know, banjo, etc., are, you know, at the core of the album, with the electric guitar being more of a, you know, creating some fills and atmosphere and textures, but not being the central central aspect of the sound.
No, and shout out to Lenderman. We reviewed his solo record back on episode 948, but I think we made the point at that time he's a better team player than solo artist.
And he definitely shows it here. You can see why all these artists want to work with him. He's a very empathetic guitarist. The songs are coming from the perspective of a young woman who has seen a few things. I mean, Katie's been around. You did mention that she's, you know, her lyrics are a cut above. She's in her 30s now, and the big themes she's addressing is what it means to stay the course. She's not talking about, yeah, you know, holding relationships together, And the work required to do that.
Adulting, they call it. Yes.
It's a new concept for some of us. Some of us are still trying to get there.
Yeah.
It's time to figure out what's worth holding on to and then do what it takes to make that endure. And that's not a very sexy topic from the outside looking in.
365 days. Tell me you're a wounded soldier. You ain't had much luck, but grace is in the eye of the beholder. I had my own ideas, but I carried you on my shoulders anyways. Ooh.
Okay, that sounds kind of boring to me, but man, she's the level of detail that she brings to these songs and the insight she's bringing to them, I found very moving by the time I got through it a few times. Burns Out at Midnight, that song, I wanted to play that as sort of the intro to this segment. Might be good on my own, but I ain't running away. I want to chase it to the end.
Yeah.
Might be good on my own, but I ain't running away. I want to chase it to the end. When I see in a vision.
Basically saying I want to stay the course here.
Yeah, and it ain't going to be easy. And you're right, the album's a grower. And it's because of lines like that and those subtle melodies that, you know, I found myself after listening once or twice, I'm thinking, okay. And then I realize how many of those melodies I'm humming while I'm making coffee or doing the dishes.
Yeah, great stuff. That's what we thought of the new albums from Sir and Waxahachie. And now we want to hear from you. Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. When we return, we'll have a discussion about the merits and pitfalls of Led Zeppelin. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Take it easy, honey. Catch me towing.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. This week, we're doing a deep dive on one of our favorite bands ever, Led Zeppelin. We'll be talking about the great music, the bombast, and, of course, the unconscionable behavior of Zeppelin's members and inner circle. And in addition to our perspectives, we're chatting with a relatively new expert on the band.
We want to welcome to the show Bob Spitz, the author of Led Zeppelin, the biography. What else needs to be said other than it's a hefty tome? Bob, welcome to Sound Opinions.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much.
Let's start at the beginning. Many reviewers are saying, why did the world need another Led Zeppelin biography? You actually have confessed you didn't own Led Zeppelin albums until you decided to take on this story. What drove you as an acclaimed biographer, not only of rock superstars, the Beatles book, but, you know, Ronald Reagan and Julia Child. What made you say there's a story that hasn't been told fully about Led Zeppelin?
Well, first of all, you know, I wasn't aware of Led Zeppelin's legacy. I had been on the road with Bruce Springsteen the whole time that they were popular, and our paths didn't cross. So if you would ask me at the beginning of this to name a couple Led Zeppelin songs, I might have been able to name, you know, Whole Lot of Love and Stairway to Heaven, but that was about it. And so when my editor asked me to consider undertaking this, I went and I read, you know, a dozen books that were at the top of the list for Zepp. And I thought that they, you know, it's the same thing you encounter in a lot of rock and roll genres. It's hagiography written by fanboys or guys who were beat, you know, journalist for Melody Maker and knew these guys and had been paid to go on tour with them. And I thought, you know, this is bogus. This is a band that has sold more albums than anyone but the Beatles. And if that is what is serving as their legacy, then somebody needed to step in here and really write the story. You know, I had seen that Hammer of the Gods was kind of the book that everybody was turning to. And I read that and I thought, wow, you know, if you call that even-handed journalism, we're all in trouble here. So I thought to start at the beginning, to let the story fill me up as somebody who knew nothing about this band and to look at them in an objective way. I spent 5 years listening to their music and talking to people like Jeff Beck and Carmine Appice so that they could really fill me in on what was happening musically with the band.
Did you feel that any of those books hit the mark? It's 100+ books on Led Zeppelin now, right? And I assume you read a good portion of them, if not all of them.
I ordered all of them and looked through all of them, yeah.
What were they not telling that your research dug up, that you were able to sort of say I filled in this gap in our knowledge of Led Zeppelin?
Well, all of Jimmy's younger years, discovering the music. You know, I was in touch with his next door neighbor, Dave Williams, who introduced Jimmy to the blues and sat with him every day while they discovered new music and talked about rock and roll and practically invented the fuzz bass with Roger Mayer. I went to find Roger, who went on to, you know, revolutionize guitar sound. That was the remarkable thing. I found that Glenn, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, they all lived within 5 minutes of each other, grew up that way, and tried to piece together the whole resurgence of electric blues in the UK after World War II. So I went back to the beginning, I talked to the Yardbirds and the people involved there, and tried to put everything in a cultural context for a reader who may have enjoyed banging their head to Led Zeppelin music, but knew nothing about where this music came from. And so that was the start of something I felt that I contributed to Zepp's legacy.
You had a tough job, too, because the band had a contentious relationship with the press all along.
Yes.
Basically, as you detail in your book, the only people who really got interviews were the people who were completely bought and paid for by Led Zeppelin's publicity machine, such as it was. And they don't do interviews, and when they do interviews, they're not easy to talk to, necessarily. And you did make that request, right, and got turned down, and which I would imagine for a biographer, that's got to be the worst news you could ever possibly hear.
When I did make the request, they all agreed to talk to me. But it happened about 2 months before Me Too hit. And the minute that Me Too hit, they pulled all of the accessibility that I had to the other members of the band. Their lawyers told me that they're not going to talk to you, they're not going to talk to anybody, because of, especially at the height of Me Too, when everything was just bursting wide open.
No place to stay.
You know, you're talking to a lifelong Led Zeppelin fan. I learned to play drums by playing along House of the Holy in my headphones. I still can't get that intro to rock and roll, which, you know, Bonzo stole from Little Richard. I got the Three Rings Ballantine Ale symbol, Bonzo symbol, on my bass drum foot. I came away from this extensively reported book more conflicted than ever by the central question of our time as critics. Greg and I have spoken about this. We continue to talk about it, to think about it, separating the art and the artist. I came away, despite having read Hammer of the Gods and every other Zeppelin book, I've got a dozen of them on my shelf that I kept, liking them as people much less, being disgusted by much of the behavior, but I still love the music.
Well, of course.
I've always been a critic, you know, squeeze the lemon till the juice runs down my lip. It's just a bad line. It was a bad line in the late 60s. It's a bad line today. On the other hand, man, when the drums come in on Stairway to Heaven. Okay. You know, you lay out the facts. There is some coloring where you know, every time Laurie Maddox's name is mentioned, you remind us, 14-year-old girlfriend, Laurie Maddox. Where do we stand? Where do you stand? Because Page was a world-class jerk, you know, and several times you tell us horrifying tales of behavior, more factually related than Hammer of the Gods, the infamous sand shark incident, Bonham assaulting a stewardess on the starship. And, you know, your refrain, which comes from Page's idiotic worship of Crowley, do what thou wilt, right? Now, I will remind you, Crowley perverted do what thou will is the whole of the law. It came from the Wiccan creed, Dorothy Reed, which was do what thou wilt is the whole of the law, so long as ye shall harm none.
Right.
Led Zeppelin left a trail of bodies in its wake.
Yeah.
They didn't harm none.
When I started out, my wife had to very carefully sit me down and say, you cannot call those people that were with Jimmy young women. They are girls. Don't ever refer to them as young women. They were adolescents. And I have to tell you that, yes, Laurie was 14 years old, but there were accounts I heard of 12-year-olds and 11-year-olds in one case. They were spelled out to me by the women, now women, in no uncertain terms. And I had to leave some of those stories out of the book because I found that it was taking over the book. I mean, I had to be a little more even-handed about it. I was torn all the way through this because, unlike you, I wasn't a fan, and I was becoming a fan by listening to the music, by really digging into it, and as a musician myself, and feeling that tear of how can I listen in a certain way when I'm reading these horrific stories and having women tell me firsthand stories, things that I couldn't put in the book. Yeah, it's tough. I don't know where you draw the line. Nevertheless, I feel that these guys have to be responsible for their behavior. And so if they're not being held responsible by the law, maybe my book is one step in the way of holding their feet to the fire by retelling some of these stories in more graphic detail so that people can understand that, you know, yes, there is that music that we love, but remember who these guys are at heart. And so you, as a listener, as a young kid, you have to absorb all of this when you listen to Led Zeppelin. At least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Led Zeppelin certainly was one of the most notorious, if not the most notorious example of the hedonism that just completely... And we were young and we were high, and that excuse no longer plays where
nobody
is buying that anymore as an excuse. But it seemed to be so ubiquitous in the 60s and 70s as a badge of rock and roll outlaw behavior, you know, where the marauders going, you know, marching up and down the pillaging and raping, literally, as we're marching through the country.
Well, and the David Bowie circle of groupies was intersecting with the... And Bowie gets a pass.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, you know, they all get a pass. The Stones, all of them.
Michael DeBar told me stories of, you know, managers during that time in L.A. with huge, you know, resources of cocaine, using it to... to control the whole action that was going on. I couldn't name them because some of those guys were still alive, and I couldn't get a second source to go on for me. So it's hard to do that. But it was a really dicey period in rock and roll. It really is. The music was better than ever, but the behavior was worse than ever.
Well, I think your book does a pretty good job of getting at the innovation that was within the music. I mean, there was so much groundbreaking stuff that Page was doing, not only as a guitar player, but as a producer. And I'm really glad you highlighted that, because the guy's genius for arrangement and stuff was incredible. John Paul Jones's crucial role in that as well. Bonham's brilliance as a drummer, Plant's innovation as a vocalist. These were all, you come across that stuff. The musical side is really astonishing. But then you have two certified monsters lurking within the inner circle of the Zeppelin, between Bonham and his behavior and Peter Grant. You know, I've read some stuff about Grant, and you pretty much lay out in pretty direct detail. This guy, he was not only was he not a nice man, he was a murderous dude.
He was a mobster.
Yeah.
He was a thug.
But, you know, the other side of the coin is, and this is where, you know, we're torn with everything, is that so many managers ripped off their bands. Peter Grant made sure those guys got every cent that they were entitled to. And he was one of the few managers, for better or worse, who was at every single gig that his band did. Now, yes, maybe he shouldn't have been there because his behavior was absolutely atrocious. And he was a mobster. He was a thug. I believe I refer to him as a villain throughout the book, which was the UK term for somebody like this. So there again, as a biographer of a great musical band, I'm torn again, not just with the guys and their music, but the manager and his fidelity to the band, and yet his horrific behavior as a human being. And I'm also being held to, my feet are being held to the fire, because every single review that has come out about my book hasn't said anything about my writing or the music or the job that I've done. They're reviewing the behavior of the band. Mm. I can't get away from it. You know, it's really tough.
I mean, there's two sides to Peter Grant, right? In some ways, he was redressing the record companies chronically screwing over their musicians and promoters and everybody else in the world, you know, for him.
Which he saw firsthand by representing Little Richard and Chuck Berry and the guys who got screwed by promoters all the time.
Yeah, he wasn't going to let that happen to his boys. Now, whether he needed, you know, guns and baseball bats to enforce that, yeah. You know. When we return, we'll talk about the brilliant but volatile drummer of Led Zeppelin, John Bonham. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. This week, we're chatting with Led Zeppelin biographer Bob Spitz. Let's get back to the conversation.
Bonham, it just breaks my heart. The rules for anybody, journalists, unwise enough, and we've spoken to Cameron Crowe, we've spoken to Jan Uhelski, we know what it was like to be on Starship. There were two rules. Never talk to anyone in the band unless they first talk to you. Number two, do not make eye contact of any kind with John Bonham ever. This is for your own safety. It kills me, you know, having studied his drumming and his brilliance and listened to what he accomplished, that basically you portray him and Plant as two kids from the sticks, Midlands, right? They grew up in the middle of nowhere. They were never going to make it. They weren't going to ever be cool. Plant becomes the golden god, and Bonham redefines the role of rock drumming. But every minute he's away from his wife and child, he is miserable. When he's miserable, he drinks. When he drinks, he becomes violent. And it's like, wow, how do we square the genius of his playing with the stories later in life when he's also taking heroin as well as being a horrible alcoholic? He would literally fall asleep at times on the drum set.
Somebody told me, and it's in the book, that Bonham was a 12-year-old boy in the body of a 25-year-old man. And he never grew up and out of that. I got tired of everybody who was on tour with the band and all the Led Zeppelin personnel saying, but the guy was a teddy bear, you know? I didn't want to hear that he was a teddy bear. He could be nice at times, but he hurt people. And then again, when I put those headphones on and Carmine sat with me and explained exactly what Bonham was doing with his feet and with his hands, I came to believe that he was the best musician in the band. I mean, when you put those cans on and listen to what he's doing as a musician, it's impossible for me to sometimes follow the timing that he's doing. I don't know how he played triplets with his feet. But aside from all of that, I could never get past the fact that anytime he veered into the story, there was going to be trouble because he didn't understand reality and he was a big boy and he hurt people. And that kind of tore at me all through the writing of the book.
No, I mean, he had no control of his behavior when he drank, and he drank all the time. Danny Goldberg surfaces as their publicist, junior publicist, right? The old school Hollywood guy, Lee Salters, says, I don't know what to do with these guys. Danny Goldberg takes him on, becomes huge in the music business. I bring him up because Danny Goldberg is overseeing the career of Nirvana 25 years later. Kurt Cobain is killing himself with heroin. Nobody does anything. You know, John Bonham is killing himself with heroin and booze. Jimmy Page is killing himself with heroin. Nobody does anything. You know, I know the 70s, 75, 79 is different than 2022. But even if it's only for self-preservation, I don't want to derail the gravy train and have these people die. I'll have no more band, which is exactly what happened with Zeppelin when Bonham dies. You would just think somebody at some point would have stepped forward. But you know, nobody did with Nirvana either.
These guys were a law unto themselves. In fact, I used that phrase in the book a few times. And they made it clear that you do not want to interfere in anything they're doing. You know, it was the same. You brought up the mention at the beginning of our discussion of about how they dealt with the press. I think it was one of the things that absolutely destroyed them. The fact that they suspected the press, they didn't treat the press well, that, you know, they always worried that they couldn't understand how the Stones were getting so much publicity and sold one third of the amount of albums that they sold. And it's because these guys never put themselves out. I've been on the road with Keith Richards, and if you walk down the street with Keith and a fan comes up, Keith puts his arm around the fan. He takes a selfie with him. He takes his skull ring off and puts it on the kid's hand. If you had tried doing that with Jimmy Page, you would have had your arm broken.
Right. By the thugs around him, yeah.
Right. Yes, absolutely. You know, and because of all of that, and because of the fact that they wouldn't take advice for their health from anybody, I say that Led Zeppelin was their own worst enemy. They really were. They screwed themselves so many times by not listening to voices of reason. They could have been embraced in such a bigger way by all of those old farts from the 60s who didn't want to accept Led Zeppelin. If they had embraced the press, if they had gone out of their way to be part of the rock and roll community, they would have been even bigger than they were.
Yeah, but don't you think, on the flip side, don't you think it was a brilliant strategy in a way? We see a generational divide. You know, John Mendelsohn famously tears them to shreds several times in a row in Rolling Stone. Right? Mendelsohn's godheads were the Kinks. Right? But the Kinks were another generation. Even though, you know, hey, Jones and Plant were part of that studio crowd that was making Kinks records, right? Yeah. They were the same age, but they were a new generation. And, you know, that thing about the press, I mean, now there's few working music critics, to the extent that any of us work, you know, who don't hold Zeppelin in as high a regard as the Stones and the Beatles.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I just don't understand why it bothered them in 1975. They're selling more. They're selling out. They're breaking every record can be broken in live performance. They're breaking records with selling the records. And the crowd of younger kids that love them devoutly. Who cares what John Mendelsohn thought?
Yeah, right. And they're still selling records, and yet they're still being aloof. Jimmy is such an aloof guy. I mean, really, these guys weren't friends with each other. Yeah, they really weren't. I couldn't find any example in all the research that I did where they ever went out and shared a meal together. When I wrote the Beatles book, what astounded me more about the Beatles was when they went anywhere, when they toured anywhere, they didn't take suites like Led Zeppelin. They took one hotel suite and they all lived with each other because they loved each other. They were mates. Even at the end, when they were suing each other over the end of Apple, Ringo would take a vacation with Paul. George and John would go out together. John would knock on Paul's door to help him finish a song. I mean, Led Zeppelin, they were not interactive at all.
Wondering, you know, Greg, you've talked to Page, right?
Yeah.
You know, I've done some in-depth interviews with John Paul Jones, and we've had Robert Plant on the show. Plant, it seems, was clueless and young and almost, you know, regrets his behavior then. Jones, I think, has fascinating perspective because he was right there, but he stepped away when the going got ugly.
Well, that was his line. And, you know, he's the one guy that always comes away from a Led Zeppelin telling John Paul was not part of this mess that was going on in their private lives, you know? He seemed to be more disciplined.
Look, you know, if you read my account of the whole shark and mud shark.
He was there, yeah.
He was peeping through the door, you know? I mean, he was part of it. But to a much lesser extent. I mean, on the road, he wasn't involved in that whole scene at all. So He was a more stable, more down-to-earth guy, even from the start.
You know, Page needed a guy like that at his side to sort of, you know, help flesh out. You know, musically, they were genius in a lot of ways. I do want to ask a musical question.
Sure.
John Bryan, who was a great producer, done a lot of those Paul Thomas Anderson soundtracks. I'm sure you're familiar with the name. He's a L.A.
studio
whiz. And a really smart guy and a great song craftsman. And he says to me years ago in an interview, I asked him about, you know, what makes a great song. And he used Led Zeppelin as an example of a band that did not write, quote unquote, great songs.
Absolutely.
What they did was great performance pieces that, if performed by anyone else other than these four people, wouldn't be all that special. Because these four guys were playing them, this is what made that music come alive. This is what gave it combustibility and its enduring value. But it was not a song-oriented band at all.
Jimmy couldn't write songs. Jimmy didn't write songs. Jimmy wrote riffs, and he embroidered them together. And that's why almost all of their songs have rhythm changes, timing changes, because and some of them don't sound like they fit together. And that's because Jimmy had all these riffs that he would bring to it, and just he'd crochet them together into a song. I mean, Stairway to Heaven is a prime example. And that made things much more difficult for Robert as well, trying to fit lyrics to what Jimmy was writing. And I think that's, yes, you were right. They were fantastic performance pieces. These guys knew how to put it across. And it wasn't just the music, it was the whole experience of having the sound course through your body when you jacked it up to 14.
The other aspect that your book touches on, and in discussions with my friends about Led Zeppelin, which became more pronounced, you know, living in Chicago, I couldn't escape. I knew Willie Dixon. And boy, he's got a few things to say about Led Zeppelin, you know. Eventually got his royalty money, but he had to fight for it. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of lifting these folk and blues standards, you know, that were part of the lexicon. And you knew these guys were poring over these records. They adored them. Page loved them. And at the same time, just sort of taking them and, you know, hey, we wrote this new song. And, oh, it just happens to sound a lot based on, you know, an old blues standard. But it's, you know, it's become our thing because of what we do to it. Obviously, that hasn't held up really well in the decade since, of musicians getting ripped off. And here was the band that worship these guys ripping them off. Like, for example, when the Stones would do that, they would give the publishing to the people they were ripping off. Not the case with Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, the whole rationale, I think, Jimmy's and Robert's rationale was that, you know, these blues guys and traditional songs were handed down, and so they felt that they had the right to take the blues songs that were handed down through time and put their own stamp on them. Unfortunately, they just put their name on the songwriting credits, and you can't do that. I mean, you just can't do it. They paid the price, but there were other instances where they just ripped guys off too. And yeah, it's hard to figure, you know, was it naivete? Did they think they were getting away with something? I'm not sure, you know, but you know, the way Jimmy screwed Glyn Johns out of a producer's credit on the first album makes me wonder if he just didn't feel, hey, listen, those guys are old, I'm going to rip them off and we'll see if we can get away with it. And, you know, Peter Grant could solve the thing with Glyn Johns, and Glyn could walk away from it going, I wash my hands of our friendship. But these old blues cats, they deserve their royalties, and it caught up with Led Zeppelin.
When you said that Jimmy thought about, I think this guy was a genius, instinctual musician, but I think he's an empty vessel. I don't think there's a there. I mean, only an idiot could become so enamored of all this hocus pocus, Aleister Crowley. And I say that as someone who's read deeply about Crowley, okay? You know, and all this other stuff, this guy, you know, he's just, the guy was a dope.
Jimmy was an only child. I'm not saying that only children have a right to be.
Not only a dope, but a raging egotist. You know, because Grant, as far as Grant was concerned, this was his band. The only one who mattered was Jimmy Page, and the only one who had to be pleased at every turn. Whatever Jimmy wants, Jimmy gets.
You know, I can say that when Mike Appel and I were managing Bruce Springsteen, we said the same thing. Whatever Bruce wants, Bruce gets. It's his band. Nobody else really matters but Bruce. But the truth,
Bruce isn't a dope.
Bruce had a moral center and a real vision of self that was wonderful. And so that made our job very easy. Jimmy was an only child. His father called him boy to the day he died, never called him Jimmy. His mother, you know, thought he was a gift from God. And who knows? For an 11-year-old boy to sit in his room with just a guitar and Aleister Crowley books, you know, that's his development in adolescence from the time he's 11 years old until the time he starts to play with Reddy Lewis and the Redcaps when he's 15. You know, you have to wonder what kind of how that all wrapped up and had an influence on the man that Jimmy became. And I think we know.
Yeah, well, it's the same line as you said with Bonham. He was a 6-year-old trapped in the body of a grown man.
It takes us back to how we started this conversation, and that is, you know, how do you separate everything? And then you hear that music, and that music just sends you into outer space.
You came into that book as a sort of a Led Zeppelin newbie. Then you spent 5 years with the music. What emerges as, for you, the Led Zeppelin album or song that completely blew your mind?
The quintessential track, Bob.
Oh, for me, it's Kashmir. I mean, I just think that Kashmir is such a wonderful piece of music. It's Robert writing at his most poetic. It was something that really meant something to him. The track is gorgeous.
All I see turns to brown. As the sun.
But then again, for somebody like me, you know, who didn't know anything about Led Zeppelin, who didn't really care for their music when I first started, an album for me like Presence really sends me into outer space because it's the way music should be made. It was made fast. It was made in 12 days. It sounds like a garage band. It wasn't smoothed off over and over and over by Jimmy until the spontaneity was gone. For me, it's all their own Presence too. So I entered this knowing nothing about them, thinking they were just a heavy metal headbanging band. And I came away, you know, really admiring their musicianship and what they've left us with, that catalog of songs that will last for another 50 years as well. So few groups are able to do that.
We've been talking to Bob Spitz, author of Led Zeppelin, the biography, a heavy book. Listen, Greg, heavy, heavy book, a heavy book about a heavy band. Thank you, Bob.
My pleasure. It was great talking to you guys. I've admired your work for a long time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
That wraps up our conversation about Led Zeppelin. And as always, now we want to hear from you. Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, one of my favorite artists of the last dozen years or so, Jay Lynn, who is incorporating everything from house music to classical music in her recordings. They're amazing. Really a privilege to talk to her. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.